Guys, we're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. In your packets, you have the minutes from February 15th. If Representative Green wants to move the minutes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Representative Green moves the minutes for February 15th, 2017. All those in favor of the minutes?
Aye.
All those opposed? The minutes for February 15th are adopted. We have before us Ms. Jamie Tincher, Chief of Staff for the Governor's Office, and Amanda Simpson, if you guys want to come to the table and provide your budget presentation. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present information about the Governor's Office budget. I have the brief background information to provide to the committee, and then I'd be glad to answer any questions. My name is Jamie Tincher. I serve as Chief of Staff to Governor Mark Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith. With me today is Amanda Simpson, Director of Operations for the Office of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor. Amanda has served the Governor's Office for more than 10 years under two administrations. She served previously as the manager of the Governor's residence. The Office of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor serves all Minnesotans. Our entire team is focused on fulfilling the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's commitment to building a better Minnesota. The work of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor includes managing the day-to-day operations of state government, an organization of more than 30,000 employees, providing a multitude of critical services for the people of Minnesota. Our office provides oversight for 24 cabinet-level departments and 59 non-cabinet-level executive agencies, fills judicial vacancies, and appoints more than 1,300 Minnesotans to about 140 boards and commissions. The governor serves as chair of the State Executive Council, the State Board of Investment, the Land Exchange Board, and the Board of Pardons. He is commander-in-chief of the Minnesota National Guard and oversees emergency response for the state. And as you know, he develops biennial budgets and policy recommendations for consideration in the legislature. The structure and operation of our office is designed to best serve Governor Dayton as he makes decisions and carries out his responsibilities as chief executive of the state. Reporting to me, but with direct access to the governor and lieutenant governor, is a core team of senior managers responsible for the functions of the governor's office, including policy development, legal counsel, legislative relations, communications, appointments, scheduling, intergovernmental relations, emergency management and homeland security, and administrative support. Every day, the governor and lieutenant governor are guided by their commitment to improving the lives of all Minnesotans. We've built a team that works together and with department and agency heads, always with the goal of making state government more accessible and responsive to the people of Minnesota. Staff costs are the largest portion of our operating budget because our greatest asset is the talent and productivity of our people. It is critical that Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith have a team of high-performing, high-caliber professionals, experts in their fields, who are able to carry out the important responsibilities of this office. Additionally, the nature of the work demands flexible people who are skilled at responding quickly during times of crisis while still maintaining a consistent level of service to constituents that is both supportive and timely. The members of our policy team serve as liaisons with the state legislature and state executive branch agencies, act as ambassadors to the legislature and stakeholders on policy and legislative issues. They coordinate the development of the governor's legislative agenda, monitor bills and proposals moving at the legislature, conduct research, and provide briefings to the governor and lieutenant governor. Our communications team is the point of contact for the media, and they support the governor and lieutenant governor in communicating their priorities and positions to the people of this state. Our office deals with varied, complex, and numerous legal issues. Some relate to formal responsibilities of the office, such as making appointments to the state judicial branch, deciding whether to grant pardons, and preparing the state to deal with emergency and crisis situations. Other legal issues are less predictable, and therefore it is essential our legal team is able to effectively address many diverse legal questions that arise. Our office receives a large volume of mail, email, telephone calls, and constituent visits. In general, these contacts fall into four major categories. First, urging the governor to take a specific position or seeking the governor's position on state legislation or other policy-related matters. Second, requesting the governor or lieutenant governor's participation in a meeting or event or seeking time on their calendars. Third, requesting the governor's assistance on an issue or help in obtaining services from state government. And four, requesting recognition as special achievements or milestones by organizations and or individual Minnesotans. Since 2011, Governor Dayton has filled 127 judicial vacancies, increasing racial and ethnic diversity in the judiciary by 83%. He has appointed 2,400 citizens to 140 boards and commissions, increasing diversity of appointees by 65%. For all appointments, we have a team that tracks expiring terms and vacancies, identifies and recruits candidates for vacant positions, verifies credentials, and coordinates the background check process on applicants. In April 2016, we created the position of Chief Inclusion Officer in the Governor's Office. In this role, James Burrows is overseeing the state of Minnesota's efforts to ensure that the state's workforce reflects the rich diversity of Minnesota by increasing economic opportunity for people of color, people with disabilities, veterans, and others who are underrepresented in our workforce, increasing state contracting opportunities for racially diverse businesses, and increasing the state's civic engagement and partnerships with communities of color and other diverse communities. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, the Office of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor works to provide the highest quality service to the people of Minnesota. That is the standard of excellence that Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith have set for all of us and for all of state government. Our staff is extremely dedicated. We are increasingly proud of the work that we do to create a better Minnesota. We are ready and committed to delivering the very best results for Minnesotans during the remaining 23 months of this administration. With that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we look forward to taking your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Tinsher. I've got Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One issue that I've been tracking is the diversity of the state's workforce to the extent that it reflects the state's workforce. Can you tell me where you're at with moving forward with the goals that have been set forward in terms of reaching to that diversity?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, the governor set out a number of goals in the area of racial and ethnic representation. He has set the goal that by the time that he leaves office, he would like the state's workforce to reflect the diversity of Minnesota. And so he set a goal for us to meet 20% by the time he leaves office. When he set that goal, we were at 8%. We are now at 11% in the state workforce. We also have goals around the disability community and reflecting and matching the available workforce. We have a lot of work to do. What we've seen in really focusing and being intentional around these efforts is that there is the recruitment piece, the making sure that job opportunities are communicated broadly and that people know what opportunities there are in state government for employment. There's also how we conduct the interview process, minimum qualifications, how we screen applicants. Are we being accessible and providing those opportunities? Are there barriers in that portion of the process that we should review and eliminate? The biggest portion of reaching our goals is going to be the retention piece. Do we have a respectful, inclusive workplace where people feel valued, where they feel like they can bring their whole self to work? That's in many ways the hardest piece and what will lead to our best success if we can really figure out how to tackle that piece.
Representative Johnson?
One last question having to do with state emergencies. I think back to the avian flu and that whole incident. What did the governor's office, what was their role in dealing with that type of statewide emergency that, you know, put a lot of people in a difficult spot?
Ms. Fincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, avian flu and then any number of other emergencies are similar in sort of the governor's office response. So when we were very concerned about any potential of an Ebola crisis here in Minnesota or, you know, monitoring, watching for Zika, anything like that, specifically to the avian flu crisis. Our Department of Agriculture partnered immediately with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They had boots on the ground here in Minnesota, around Minnesota, doing any number of tracking cases to working hand in hand with farmers who were turkey producers who were being devastated by this situation. And so we played a coordinating role. We had a staff member who was intricately involved in all of the discussions, making phone calls to the federal government, to any of our contacts there, making sure that we were coordinating our efforts, working with the legislature on any resources that were going to be needed, and really playing the role of cutting through and eliminating any sort of time gap that was going to take, that was going to happen because people were, how do we make a decision, how do we get some things moved along? And so we had a staff person who was dedicated to that the entire time.
Representative Thank you, Madam Chair. That's fine.
Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Curious, the special revenue fund, could you explain what that is or how that works? It's on this summary sheet that you gave us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Ms. Simpson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Simpson. I'm the Director of Operations with the Governor's Office. The Special Revenue Fund was set aside in 2004 during the
Can you maybe speak in? There's like a fan that goes on, and it's hard to hear.
So Madam Chair, is that better?
That's better. Thank you.
Thank you. The Special Revenue Fund was set aside in 2004 during the Pawlenty administration for the interagency agreements between the governor's office and our different agencies. The Special Revenue Fund is used to fund salary positions in specific departments like our legal, constituent service, policy, and communications teams, as well as our diversity and inclusion office.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I noticed that it's increased significantly from 2012, where it was $685,000, up to $1,363,000 projected in 2017. And I'm just curious, and plus the expenditures, you know, we've added 5.5 full times in those few years. Just curious what they've been doing or what the cause of that might be.
Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have seen growth in all of those departments, as well as the creation of the inclusion department. Sorry. So that is correct.
Representative Vogel?
So, Madam Chair, well, I guess the concern I might have is that each one of the department's budgets that are contributing the extra, $500,000 now, that's going into their operating expense, so I suppose it makes them much more difficult than to budget themselves because they're paying a higher assessment. So I don't. There's probably not a question there, but more of a comment that it's good that you're doing this stuff, but it also probably is making it a little more difficult on a lot of the agencies because they're paying a higher assessment, right?
Ms. Simpson? Ms. Pimcher?
I would say that, as I said in the opening remarks, the coordination between our office and each of our agencies is critical. And so their ability to have someone that is liaisoning directly with the governor, communicating things back. Operationally, there's just so much efficiency that is created by the positions in our office that are directly working with our agencies. So I believe the agencies see a lot of value in the staff that is dedicated to their needs.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. I guess we'll just have to trust that they are.
I think for my purposes, it would be helpful for me to know with the increase that they've had, what has that money gone for specifically? I mean, this is on this spreadsheet, it's pretty generic. So if you can provide more of those details. And then, Ms. Simpson, do you remember what was the amount in 2004 when it was first opened?
Madam Chair, I do not have that amount with me. I can definitely get that for you.
That would be great.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fincher, question for you. Mm-hmm. I see in the recommended, in the big budget book, the governor has asked for 46.7 FTEs in the office. Your 14 numbers were 38.7. Can you tell us that's an increase of 8 FTEs? What are those going for? And help us understand that, if you would.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative. So in designing the office, every year There are new things that I look at. You know, when I, in my opening comments, I talked about our legal staff, our policy staff, creating the inclusion office. So I don't know that it's a one-for-one from, you know, the that time to current. Really what I'm looking at every day is how are we best serving the needs of the governor and lieutenant governor, and there are issues that, whether it's rail safety, the focus on water, early education, there are departments that on a year-to-year basis they may grow in one area because we're responding to a certain need. So some of that growth may be additional policy staff that weren't necessarily there. I know that we've expanded our legal team, so I would have to go back and look at, you know, exactly which areas.
And Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, eight FTEs is a pretty sizable increase, and I don't know what the increase over time was when the governor first came into office. I wasn't serving the legislature then. But, you know, certainly over the 14-15 biennium, that's a pretty sizable jump. And I know you just put this together. So if you could maybe kind of give us some ideas, or if you wouldn't mind getting us that information after the fact, I'm sure the entire committee would really appreciate knowing what eight FTEs are going for. And I know you can't say, well, this person over here is for this specific thing. And I'm sure you kind of share parts of FTEs, as I've learned here. We have as little as 0.3 of an FTE for a certain area. But if you could, maybe just get us some of that breakdown so that we can share that with the committee so that as we're moving forward on the budget, we can understand what those eight FTEs are for.
Absolutely. And Ms. Fincher, why an expansion on the legal team when the AG is our representative for that?
So I can give some detail on sort of the amount of legal work that we do, extraditions, things that are specific to our office. Our legal team also handles all of our data practices. There's just a substantial amount of work that happens in that team. And what I was going to expand on is when I look at the office, I am always trying to figure out how can we be more responsive, faster, more efficient, respond to the things that Minnesotans are, you know, asking us to provide service on. And so when I look at our constituent outreach office, there are thousands of requests that come in, and a lot of that is casework for Minnesotans. And so anytime that I'm going to have an ability to add staff so that we are answering phones, answering emails, getting things resolved for Minnesotans faster, that's what we're going to do. And so what I would say is that expansion in the staff, wherever we can figure out how we can add to our team so that we are more effective in responding quickly to Minnesotans, we're going to find a way to do that.
Representative Nash?
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair. And could you tell me what your average FTE compensation is? What are they getting paid?
Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative Amanda, do you know? We can talk with you. I don't know what the average. I'm not sure if we have the average at this point.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will be happy to prepare that for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you could. Again, you know, thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. You know, we're working on the budgets, and we've received this not that long ago, and it would be great to know what these new FTEs, what their wage is going to be, and benefit blending and all that. So just because it is it stuck out in my mind when I was reading last night for today, and I just thought, gosh, that's a lot. You know, I'm a small business owner, and I make decisions very judiciously as to when to add staff, and this just seems like a huge jump.
Representative Vogel, to this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one relative to your questions on providing some detail, I just looked at this, and going up from 685, going up 678,000, so it's basically been a 100% increase since 2012 in those special revenues. So as much detail there as possible would be nice, just to see how that's being spent, because I think it could become a hardship on a lot of the agencies. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I liked hearing about the piece where you're doing more engagement with communities of color. You're doing more work on that. And I imagine to some of the point when we're talking about FTEs and we're talking about being more intentional about who we engage marginalized voices, you speak a bit about your civic engagement efforts. And can you talk a little bit about some constituent service or some engagement you've done with marginalized communities in new and creative ways with this administration?
Ms. Pincher?
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, a good example is in our appointments team. So what we realized was with the appointments process, there's the announcement of, you know, appointments that are available. It was a very passive process, I think, in the past, where if you knew where to look for appointments to boards and commissions and things that were available, you would go to that website, you would apply. What we've done in our appointments team is they host information sessions. They do a lot of outreach and networking events so that we are getting into communities and talking with community leaders about who would be good folks for us to recruit to see if they would be interested in serving on boards and commissions. As you all know, the boards and commissions, whether they are small and very focused on things like food safety or, you know, high-profile boards and commissions, they're really important to the functioning of Minnesota, to the safety and security and licensing processes that happen in Minnesota. And doubling down and being very intentional about making sure that we are looking for all of those voices and those communities to be involved in that process is really important to the governor and lieutenant governor.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow that up a bit, you talked about the accessible and responsive on constituent issues. Could you give an example of what that looks like as well, too, please?
Ms. Pincher.
Madam Chair, Representative, I can. A lot of our constituent services, we get thousands of calls, and a lot of the calls have to do with constituents needing help and support around human services, benefits that they need, health care, child protection issues. A lot of those calls end up being what we call casework, where someone in our office is walking through and managing a process and trying to get help and support for Minnesotan, much like what you do in your offices for your constituents. One case that that I'm particularly proud of that we worked on, there was a gentleman and his wife who lost their home because of a mudslide, and they didn't have, you know, exactly the right insurance, and we stayed on it, and it took us more than a year, but we actually got resources to that family to cover that loss that I believe without the work of the governor's office, that wouldn't have happened for that Minnesotan. And I could go on and on and tell you stories of where we're just helping everyday Minnesotans.
Representative Olson. Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So along those lines, Ms. Tincher, regarding constituent services, sort of connected also to being more intentional in your work across racial equity and equity sort of overall, I was pleased to see the governor's office make some real progress as we've been talking about the work that the governor has done with tribes, I think has been done well. And there was a real, I think, need and to have more intentional relationships with our significant urban Indian populations and sort of both the Twin Minneapolis and St. Paul. So I was pleased to see some of that reflected in the budget that the governor proposed of that investment. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, for us, much of that starts with a conversation maybe with someone in the governor's staff, connecting them to community, but could you talk a little bit about how that's sort of been embraced overall? I know the governor has set the tone in a way that I think we haven't seen before from a governor in the state regarding the need for equity and inclusion. But how is that embraced by the rest of the governor's office and team? Because he can talk about it all day long, but unless the rest of the folks sort of buy into it, it doesn't matter. So you've seen that reflected in my own community, but I'm wondering what that looks like in other communities and areas.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say it's fully embraced by the governor's staff, and we talk a lot about it in whatever issue it is, particularly in coordinating and bringing together the governor's budget recommendations. I think about the governor's senior team, and what is important to me in my role and in serving the governor and the lieutenant governor well is that I have tried to be intentional about putting around that senior table people who don't necessarily bring the same experiences or see the world the way that I do. I think that I better serve him when those other voices are there. The other thing I would say is that we've been very intentional as a cabinet in our monthly cabinet meetings, the heads of all of the agencies. We are very intentional and talk very specifically about what we're doing in each of our agencies around equity and inclusion and how, as the heads of those agencies, the commissioners are very critically involved in advancing all of the work that we're doing around hiring, contracting, and really critically the engaging in community around policies, procedures, programs, how are we designing and developing all of the services that are provided to Minnesotans? And if we aren't asking those critical questions about how things are happening in community and are we designing things the way that they are best going to get us the outcomes that we're looking for, we're missing really critical voices. So it's something that has been embraced throughout the administration.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, so as we're talking about these additional FTEs or these additional investment, do you believe it's been worth the investment for the outcomes that you've seen so far?
Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely. And I think that we're going to see the increased success of those investments. I think that the work that our equity office, our inclusion office is doing through the work of Mr. James Burrows, and his philosophy is that he is sort of a coach around how do you partner and really work with the agencies on meeting the goals that we have around representing the state of Minnesota, all of our communities, and the rich diversity that we have. We also have someone in his office who brings a lot of state government experience, and her focus is career pathways in state government and how are we designing and really thinking about career opportunities and being inclusive around those career opportunities for all of our communities.
So, Representative Flanagan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm done.
Representative Kwan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this would probably be for Ms. Tincher. Some correspondence dated February 13th to the Chair in response to some questions. I don't think in my packet I've got the complete response. So if there would be a way to be able to get that additional supplemental information, since it was, I think, meant to be available before, would be nice. But glancing at what is available, there's a summary history, FTE, and it appears to be by bargaining unit. And building off on another question, under here there's MAPE with 0.04. I'm trying, because I was on a school board, and we had trouble filling, you know, a 0.4 or a 0.3 position. You know, if there's an explanation offline, but I don't know how you get a person for 19 minutes a day, an hour and a half a week, or 80 hours a year. And it'd be nice to understand if there's sharing between different organizations, that might help us understand, you know, the general budget when we see these small fractional. But just, you know, clarification there. I did want to, and I apologize I'm being selfish, because you talked about the helping a person, there was a mudslide or something. If you can get me the information, I was at an event in Rochester. I don't know if this lady's a constituent or not, but her doctor told her that her life-saving procedure that she would need isn't covered by the insurance. They tried an exemption, etc. It used to be in the previous insurance. We all know this is a complex, but unfortunately not a individual. So if you could get that information to me, and I can pass that on, because we're all here to help people. Thank you.
Ms. Tincher, do you have any follow-up?
Madam Chair, Representative, if you want, I would be happy to get the constituents' information and follow up with you and see if there's anything we can do to help with that. And then I do know, yes, I will follow up. And then I know that Ms. Simpson can answer your question on the MAPE piece.
Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative, we receive assistance from SMART, the Small Agency Resource Team, and they bill through payroll. And the two employees that work with us are representatives represented by the MAPE and MMA. So what you're seeing is the percentage of work they do for us as billed through our payroll.
Thank Representative Klaus?
No, that takes care of it. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Detmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Ms. Tincher. I'm looking at the small agency profile here, and then there is one bullet point that I'm attracted to. I chair the Veterans Committee, the division, which falls underneath this committee. And as we know, the governor is the commander-in-chief of our armed forces, the National Guard and Air National Guard. And could you explain to the committee here how he's engaged with these two organizations, the TAG and also the Veterans Affairs with Commissioner Shelato, and then the TAG is General Nash. Mm-hmm. How does he relate and how does he work with these two organizations? And do they meet regularly, especially when they're looking at their budgets and so forth? So.
Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, he did. The governor met with General Nash and with General Shelato on both of those budgets as he meets with cabinet heads. And then on an as-needed basis, he meets with General Nash and General Shelato to get routine updates. If things are happening in their agencies, they typically will call me, and then we get something set up, and they get time with the governor.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, Madam Chair. And does the governor, does he get the information to these organizations in a timely manner when it comes to budgeting? Because many times different committees, and in terms of this committee, many times we have targets that we have to meet. And what happens sometimes when I know last year we had a problem with one of the departments and agencies, and they came in with short money. How does the governor deal with that? Because he is the commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm. So. Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that I know the issue that you're mentioning. I think what happened with, my experience with an issue, and I think this might be the issue you're talking about, there was a fundamental misunderstanding of what was going on in the Department of Veterans Affairs budget. And so they have a funding revenue stream that is unique. So they have revenue that comes in, and then they have their general fund, and then they have their federal funds. And so when they were making a request, it was unclear that they needed to make up for a loss of revenue to their homes. And so it appeared at first glance that they were asking for a far bigger increase than what all of the other agencies were asking for. But it was a misunderstanding on the fact that we needed to make up some revenue that was lost from a funding stream that happened. So once General Shelato and his staff and I sat down and we went through that, and once I understood what was going on, we corrected for that. And so it may be that lag in time was that we had some just miscommunication on what was going on at the beginning.
Madam Chair, and so what we're probably saying is that something like that is not going to happen again. What precautions can you take so that things like this don't happen, especially at the end of the session almost?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, I was thinking about this in response to the growth in FTEs and another question, but what I will say is that the efficiencies and our capacity to just be better at our jobs is oftentimes just a result of being in that job and experiencing things. So every day I learn more and more about state government, and while I can't say that we will prevent that, every day I try to be a little bit better about knowing something I didn't know the day before and responding better. So while I can't say that we will prevent a misunderstanding, we will work to correct it as quickly as possible. And I will say that it's important to me that all of the cabinet heads have direct access to me. One of the things that I've done in terms of my schedule is I try to keep windows of every day open so that things that arise and that I can help deal with them immediately. So cabinet members typically have that priority in terms of at least getting to me so that I can get to the governor when they need things.
Thank you.
Representative Ublin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. On your spreadsheets here on the special revenue funds, asking for a little more detail here. You have your transfers in, and you have it coded. And the, of course, the amounts, for instance, there's one for $247,000. But we don't know where that's coming from. You just have code numbers on that. Would it be possible for us to get the detail on that so we could see that?
Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to prepare the spreadsheet with the specific agencies for you.
Thank you. I have one other question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that we used to have an office in Washington, D.C. I was looking through the spreadsheets. I didn't see that that cost there. Do we still have that D.C. office?
Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, we no longer have representation in D.C.
Representative Ublin?
So how does that work in terms of the agencies? Are they still, I couldn't see that detail either. They're not still being charged for the support of that, are they?
Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the work that was done by the D.C. office is now done by our policy advisors within our office.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Representative Ublin?
So then those costs and everything else are still being incurred then?
Ms. Simpson? Or Ms. Tencher?
Excuse me. Madam Chair, Representative, we're no longer charging for rent the way that we were for the D.C. office, but the staff costs and the time are now being absorbed by the governor's office.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I apologize. I missed that point part because we've had different agencies that have come in that have listed it as for the federal office. So is that just for staff time, or what is that when they list that as their transfer out?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware of why they're listing it as the federal office.
Okay. We'll maybe have to have a conversation with you then at some point here. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Tincher or Ms. Simpson, I was thinking through the question that I had asked a little bit ago, and I think you had mentioned that you had brought some new employees in to handle appointments. And my question was, how many appointments have been made, and how many employees do you require to make an appointment? So kind of what's the ratio of appointments to employee? Go ahead. I'll do vice chair stuff. Ms. Tincher.
Madam Chair, Representative. So since 2011, there have been 127 judicial vacancies that have been filled. 2,400 citizens appointed to boards and commissions, and I'll have to check with that because that may be reappointments embedded in that. So, and the way that we have it structured, we have a director over the department, and then we have two individuals who work in that department under that person. And typically we focus on judicial appointments with that supervisor and one staff person, and then all other boards and commissions with the other staff person. And so in all of those, there's a lot of timelines that have to be met, vacancies when they become open, the background check process. With the judicial appointments, there is a judicial commission. So there's just a lot of logistical pieces that those staff really make sure that we're meeting those timelines and deadlines.
Sure. And Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
And I want to make sure that my question was clear. You said that the eight new employees that are in the budget, that there's some appointment personnel that are being added and that you've added personnel for that function over time. I'm just trying to figure out, so you've got a director and two people in that office? And then, so if that's the case, you know, are you expecting more appointments in the last couple of years, or what is the approach there? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Representative. So my approach to the office, I don't really think about it as so much departments in silos. And so the judicial vacancies, there is a logistical, operational piece of the paperwork, the background checks, the getting the governor scheduled so that he can do the interviews for the judicial appointees. There's those pieces of it, but our legal team also is a part of that process as well. So we have our general counsel who sits in on interviews. So there is work to fill a judicial appointment, to fill boards and commissions where some of that work we do with the policy team. So they may get a question, you know, we have this board or this commission. Are there some folks you know that we could reach out to? So a lot of the work in the governor's office is very flexible between the departments. And so from 2011 to now, it would be hard for me to, I don't know that it's linear in terms of, you know, if we have eight more FTEs than we did then, it would be hard to go back and sort of recreate, you know, where did that, you know, what specific event sort of created that. It's just a general need, and how do we fill those needs in the office.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ms. Tincher, I'm sure from an accounting perspective, maybe this is better for Ms. Simpson, you're saying, okay, so we'll just talk about the generic Bob. Bob works in your office, and today Bob's got X number of, not you, Bob, but so X number of hours are being directed towards this activity, and then X number of hours of the next day. Is that how you're viewing this? You said that they're sort of amorphous and they're kind of working on different projects. Did I hear that right, or is it actual employees that work on the appointment process? Because I'm kind of figuring out, is it that you charge back certain or account for X number of hours of a person's time? Today they're doing appointments, tomorrow they're doing something else. And maybe that's part of the information you can get us about these other employees is how do you look at their work as it relates to the appointment process?
Ms. Tension?
Madam Chair, Representative, maybe a good example would be I just believe that we shouldn't work in silos. And so in the governor's office, we are just much better at serving the needs of the people of Minnesota if there is a lot of cross-collaboration that people are communicating and collaborating on whatever task it is that we have to do. And so different people bring expertise or some support. One of the changes that we've made in the office, previous to adding the chief inclusion officer position, there was a position that was just a deputy chief of staff. And that was really a person that I would say sat beside me, did all of the sort of overflow and helped and supported the chief of staff. I eliminated that role basically because we knew that we needed to add the capacity and add that expertise and that function of a chief inclusion officer that was looking at what we were doing across the administration. So a lot of the functions, it's about figuring out, well, what is the need that we have? What is the thing that the governor and lieutenant governor want our office to be able to respond to? And then I look at the office structure and organization and the budget, and there are things that sometimes we will eliminate a certain role or that will get absorbed into the functions that a number of people will do.
Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you no longer have a deputy chief of staff, is that right?
Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, there are deputies over specific departments. Prior to the chief inclusion officer role, there was a person who was just a deputy chief of staff, so was my number two.
And Madam Chair, was that Ms. Zakula, or did I say that right?
Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, it was Dana Bailey and then Shantara Hardy.
Representative Nash?
Okay. In different roles.
You know what, maybe, Madam Chair, if we could, this is, you see where I'm going with this line of questioning. If you could maybe help me understand the increase in employees, what they're doing, and how it is that that they factor into these appointments? Because you said that you're dealing with many more appointments, and that's why you brought some more of these people in. And I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what that is.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Fincher, you'll communicate with them later?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Tischner, when you have your employees and then you're charging back the various departments and everything else, do you code their time? I applaud your idea of not having silos, okay? I understand that. But you're charging back various departments and agencies and things, and how do you know how much to charge them back? Are you coding their particular time and their duties during a project, for example, or something like that?
Ms. Tincher or Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative, during the Pawlenty administration, the group created a formula based on the federal funds and the percentages of size of each agency in order to create the percentages that we charge each agency. So we use the same percentages as the previous administration. We don't code specific work for employees, but we do look at the amount of work they do that's agency specific and then assign their salary to the special revenue fund or to the general fund.
Representative?
Madam Chair. Well, you know, for instance, MnDOT uses a coding system, and it seems to be pretty accurate in things. And my question to you is, a formula that was put into place many, many years ago, how comfortable are you with the accuracy of that formula, especially with the changing needs that your group, your department, the executive branch has had to deal with over the last number of years? It seems to me that there should be some review on that.
Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative, we could definitely look at reviewing the formula that we use. We do review the positions and the work they do for agencies, and the Chief of Staff and I regularly discuss weekly our budget and how we're assigning our employees.
Okay.
Representative, I've got a couple of questions. I'm looking at the FTE piece of it. Does this reflect all of the FTEs, or when you talk about the folks that you have embedded in the different agencies, are they reflected in this FTE count? Ms. Simpson or Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, embedded in the agencies, I'm not.
Well, you talked about
your question.
Yeah, I'm asking because you mentioned a little bit that some of the folks you kind of have, like the legal team you maybe have within an agency, so are they counted under the agency, or are they counted under the governor's office? So are there any people that are responsible to the governor's office, but they're counted under a different agency rather than the FTEs of the governor's office? Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have some people in our office that work for other agencies but are housed in our agency. We provide the space and the technology support for other employees from other agencies.
Okay. But they're not under your FTU then at all?
Madam Chair, correct. They are not listed under FTEs as they are not employees of the governor's office.
Can you provide me with a list of that?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then this is for Ms. Tincher. Well, actually, this goes back to Ms. Simpson, too. I got some clarification. So when the agencies have been coming before us that are under our purview, it's not federal office. They've been listing it as federal affairs. For the chargebacks that they're doing. So can you give me more details about those chargebacks for the federal affairs pieces for each of the agencies that have come before us? So they have in the budget piece, they list it as to the governor's office for federal affairs, and I'm more interested in what exactly does that go for? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Ms. Madam Simpson? Chair, I believe that is a relic from how they used to charge for the governor's office when there was an office in D.C., so I believe they haven't changed their coding.
Okay.
That would be my best understanding of that.
Well, then for those pieces, that if their coding reflects that, mm-hmm. can you give us an idea of what that is, mm-hmm. Then what that money is? Because the money's still coming to you, so it'd be, if it's not that federal affairs piece, I'd like to know what is the money actually for.
And, Madam Chair, I will say that we still do in our office a fair amount of work with our federal delegation, with the administration in D.C. So a lot of our agencies will come to our office, and either through the governor, the lieutenant governor, through our policy team, a lot of that federal-focused questions, letters, responses, things like that, it goes through our office. And so while we aren't, while we don't have a federal office that we are paying rent for, that function is still happening.
Okay. I think it would be helpful for me to have a better understanding of what that is. So if you can provide that information. Okay. And then I do have some questions. Earlier in the year, I had sent some letters to Ms. Tincher just asking about the whole severance deal. And I'm just curious, so we've seen a jump of 100% in the governor's office chargebacks. Did the severance package piece to the three employees, is that what resulted in the increase by 100% in the chargebacks? Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, no.
Okay, so where would we find that in the budget?
Madam Chair, I'm not following. Where would we find what?
So for each of the severance packages that the governor issued to the three different employees, Commissioner Sieben, Clark, and the, I think it was Commissioner Wright, if I have it correct. I'll have to take a look at the names again. Where did that money come from to pay for their severance packages?
Madam Chair, sorry, I'd have to look at their budgets, but that would have come from their operating compensation budgets.
So would it have come out of their agency budgets is what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay. All right. And then does the governor have a policy in place now on the severance piece of things of when he'll give it out? Does he give it out for involuntary leave or voluntary leave, or has he established that policy in place now? Or
So, Madam Chair, Amanda can speak to our office severance package, but the severance packages that you're referring to, that's laid out in statute. So when those arose, I reached out to the HR and legal professionals at the Department of Management and Budget. They laid out here were the options, and in each of those cases, the governor made a decision on the, I believe it was 2 months, 3 months, and 3 months of severance package. He was authorized up to 6 months, and so he made that determination within those parameters as laid out by statute, is my understanding.
Well, Ms. Tincher, when I look at that, so you're saying that the administration has no written policy on it at all. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the administration followed what was laid out in statute as what was applicable.
Well, there's been disagreement on the interpretation of the statute piece. And I'm just curious, you know, the governor had, there's no salary-based severance provision included in the administration's managerial plan proposal to the legislature. Is that something that the governor is going to seek here in the future, or no?
I'm not following, Madam Chair, I'm not following the question.
Well, under our current, we don't have any salary-based severance provision included in the administration's managerial plan proposal to the legislature. Is the governor going to change that, given, you know, the conversation around severance packages, or not?
So, Madam Chair, maybe it's helpful. I mean, in our plan, we have a procedure for severance packages. I think that is what every agency, whether it's the managerial plan, whatever your compensation plan are, is there are provisions for when there is a retirement, whatever sort of a termination of service. So I'm not clear. I mean, we could go through what the governor's office severance policy is as outlined in our compensation plan.
But does the governor have a policy, a written policy within his office that says when a severance package is going to be offered? Because we had some folks that left and were not provided a severance package. So I'm guessing that he has to have something in place that says when that happens, and what would that be?
Madam Chair, so we have a policy that governs our our employees in the governor's office. We'd be happy to talk about that. For the three instances that you're bringing up, again, I went to the Department of Management and Budget as laid out in statute. They told us, here is what, here are the options that are available, and the governor made a decision about those pieces. So there is no written policy outside of what the statutory language provides.
And so there's no plan in place of when you offer the benefits package at all. Is that left up to the discretion of the governor?
My understanding is that is what is in statute, is that it is at the discretion of the governor. That's my understanding. So we don't have any other policy.
Okay, Representative Ogle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and possibly to Ms. Simpson, just one more question on the transfer thing. I noticed that back in 2014, there was a transfer out for a rather small amount for a statewide executive recruiter, but now it's grown to $10,000 in 2016 and $20,000 in 17. I'm just curious what the statewide executive recruiter is.
Ms. Tincher or Ms. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the first things that we did around looking at how are we going to meet the goals of diversifying our workforce is we wanted to be very intentional and focused on the top level of government. We knew that if we could focus on those top level positions and really diversify in those top positions, we would have people in decision making positions that were going to help us with a lot of the additional work that we were going to do, so that for all 30,000 plus employees, we were going to be able to meet those goals. And so in looking at how we hire in state government, it became very clear that for top level positions, you needed to know that those positions were available, and much the same way that the private sector employees recruiting and really looking for and going out and finding top-level management and top-level talent, we needed to do that. And so the state created a statewide executive recruiter position so that we were being very intentional about when we had openings, that person works directly with the cabinet heads, our commissioners, our deputy commissioners, talks to them about what are you looking for, and then goes and creates a network of high-level professionals in the state of Minnesota that would potentially either now for that position or in the future would be interested in joining the ranks of state government. And we have found that it's been immensely successful in the, I would have to look at the numbers, but since that position has been brought on, of the new hires that we've made just in that cohort of top-level management, I believe that it was at last count, one in four of those new hires are from underrepresented communities.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up then. So is the $20,000 that's going to the governor's office the entire amount, or are there other agencies that are contributing?
Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, all of the cabinet-level agencies contribute a portion of that. The governor's office portion is a higher percentage than the size of our agency. So when we do the pro rata share, we contributed more because it was a position that we very much believed needed to be funded. And so we took on a little bit more of that cost so as to keep those costs down for the other agencies.
Representative Vogel?
Madam Chair, and so how much is the total, do you know, that's being allocated overall?
Ms. Dinscher?
Madam Chair, Representative, we can get that to you.
Representative Vogel?
Just one final question on it then. Is that expected to keep growing kind of as exponentially as it has? It went from 0 to 10,000 to 20,000. Are you projecting kind of a straight line growth, or do you see that leveling?
Ms. Tincher?
Madam Chair, Representative, I see that leveling. I think we probably took on additional, so that is probably not reflective of what has happened in the other agencies. We probably took on more.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Ms. Tincture. And this is actually to what Representative Vogel is bringing up. I'm from Greater Minnesota, and I think having representation in, you know, the executive branch from Greater Minnesota from diverse communities is really important. And we can't often leave it up to communities that are often underrepresented to find out what's going on, or we have to be active with it. So I imagine there's an element of investing in this so that we have representation from Greater Minnesota, we have representation from diverse communities. So I just want to highlight that, you know, some numbers that we have, that you've increased racial diversity in the judicial branch by 83%. There's been folks increased diversity with 65% on boards and commissions, that you've maintained equal representation in with voices from Greater Minnesota, and in some places actually increased that. So I just want to that point, just highlight the connection between those two. There has to be a correlation, and if, you know, just continuing to explain a little bit more directly about that correlation is helpful.
Ms. Tincture. Madam Chair, Representative, that's accurate. So as we have increased racial, ethnic diversity, there has also been an intentional focus on Greater Minnesota. And I will tell you, whenever I'm in the meetings on judicial appointments, boards and commissions, one of the things that the governor looks at when we provide, here are the applicants, here are the recommendations that people have received, the governor always goes back and says, well, what would be the composition? How many people from where in our state? What would this board look like? And representation from Greater Minnesota is always key for him.
Representative Olson? Members, any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Tincture, Ms. Simpson. We look forward to the information. Members, with that, we're going to take about a 10-minute recess.
What the new scratch?
We have a caucus.
272? I don't know. 362?
Well, you better check caucus.
Caucus.
St. Mary, we're going to run up to the research room at the DFL site.
Where is that?
You know where the research staff are?
On 6?
No, you know where our DFL research is? On the second floor? Follow me.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Oh. Yeah, okay. They have food for us.
Oh, they don't have Kenny's food. If I were seeing the bank last year, she stopped by to get liquor from him.
My daughter thinks they were going
I avoid looking at them for a long time to pick the details out. Please tip them.
All right. Members, I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. We've got before us House File 778. I'm going to move House File 778 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, you are probably familiar with this piece of legislation if you served in the Government Operations Committee. What it does, in effect, is it changes the structure of the MSFA board to reflect the growing concerns about the structure and management of the board itself. And so some highlights for it. First off, it takes the stadium suite pieces and makes sure that the revenue doesn't go to friends and family, but instead goes to paying off the debt on the stadium. And then also another major highlight of the piece of legislation is it also changes the structure by giving the governor one appointment, the city of Minneapolis one appointment, and then the legislature from all four legislative leaders get an appointment apiece, and then we have the legislative auditors providing oversight for that as well. So those are the highlights of the bill, and with that, I stand for questions. Okay, no questions. Members, we're going to go to amendments. Do we have a list of her? Oh, Representative Flanagan, do you want to do now, or are you doing an amendment? Or?
Yes, I have an amendment.
Okay. Which is your amendment?
The DE4.
DE4?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Flanagan has the DE4 amendment. Moves the DE4 amendment to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the DE4 amendment is a response to all the recommendations made by the legislative auditor regarding the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority. Section 1 expands the purpose for the MSFA to oversee the authority's use of suites, cabin suites, parking, food service, and other public amenities. Section 2 requires the authority to review the reports required in this bill during a public meeting of the authority. Section 3 prohibits preferential access by the authority board members and staff and other public officials to amenities at U.S. Bank Stadium, Target Field, Target Center, TCF Bank Stadium, Excel Center, River Center, and CHS Field, and applies the Code of Ethics in MS-43A.38 to the governing bodies and staff of these facilities. Section 4 expands the authority's membership, adding four appointees of the legislature to improve legislative oversight of the authority. Section 5 expands the authority's reporting requirements. Section 6 authorizes the authorities to donate its access to the stadium amenities to nonprofit organizations. Section 7 goes beyond the legislative auditor's recommendations, requesting that the legislative auditor conduct a review of the management structure of the MSFA to establish in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 47.3J, and the review shall prioritize consideration of the authority's leadership positions, including the necessity for the authorities to be simultaneously led by a full-time executive director and a full-time chair, and investigates that more. And as appropriate, the legislative authority's review may include recommendations for legislation to improve the authority's management structure. The review must be submitted to the Legislative Commission by the Minnesota Sports Facilities and the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over state government finance no later than January 15, 2018.
Okay. Is there anybody from the audience that wishes to testify on this amendment? Members, do you have any questions about this amendment? Okay. With Representative Johnson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, a roll call, please.
Representative Johnson requests a roll call. Members, I'm going to ask that you vote against this amendment. This was offered, a similar one at least, was offered in the Government Operations Committee, though I think that there is some value to some of the provisions in the amendment. I think that it doesn't go far enough in changing the structure of the MSFA board to make sure that we have accountability within our people's stadium. So with that, I would recommend a no vote, and if the clerk could take the roll, please.
Chair Anderson?
No.
Rep Nash?
No.
Rep Johnson?
Yes.
Rep Detmer?
No.
No.
Rep Benton?
No.
Rep Flanagan?
Yes.
Rep Green?
No.
Rep Tunis Ponin?
Yes.
Rep Lilly?
Yes.
Rep Odisco?
No.
Rep Olson?
Yes.
Rep Olmeyer?
Yes.
Rep Pugh?
No.
Rep Quam?
No.
Rep Uglum?
Nope.
Rep Vogel?
No.
Rep Ward?
Yes. The amendment does not pass, 7-10. Members, we have in your packet any other amendments? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A7 amendment.
Representative Johnson moves the A7 amendment to your amendment. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this amendment does, members, is specifies that an individual or private association may not give a public official, such as ourselves, preferential admission to a publicly owned event or entertainment facility like the U.S. Bank facility, for example, if the gift is due to the recipient's status as a public official, such as we are. And to make clear that a public official may not accept such a gift. So it essentially strengthens the current gift ban, clarifies it, and adds a little bit more teeth to it.
Okay. Is there
and I need a roll call, please.
Representative Johnson requests a roll call. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify to the A7 amendment? Seeing none, members, I'm going to comment on the A7 amendment. In looking at this, this actually does not cover local officials. So, example, the city of, the mayor of the city of Minneapolis or any of their city council members or county commissioners would not be banned from receiving preferential treatment. And for that reason, I would encourage a no vote. And with that, the clerk will take a roll.
Chair Anderson?
No.
Rep Nash?
No.
Rep Johnson?
Yes.
Rep Detmer?
No.
Rep Fenton?
No.
Rep Flanagan?
Yes.
Rep Green?
No.
Rep Kunis Pudding?
Yes.
Rep Lilly?
Yes.
Rep O'Driscoll?
No.
Rep Olson?
Yes.
Rep Olmeyer?
No.
Rep Pugh?
No.
Rep Quam?
No.
Rep Uglum?
No.
Rep Vogel?
No.
Rep Ward?
Yes. On a vote of 6 yes and 11 no's, the amendment does not pass. Are there any other amendments, members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A9.
Representative Ward has the A9 amendment to your amendment.
This covers the area that was discussed earlier for the two suites that Minnesota State has been managing and using, and simply provides the opportunity for donating those suites, if they were not going to be sold and used for marketing. So if there's availability that they would be used for nonprofit organizations and such, and it identifies the process for identifying and keeping track of those.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify to this amendment? Members, any questions to this amendment? Okay. Seeing none, members, for me, I'm going to recommend a no vote on this one as well. My concern is the NSFA board has shown that they've given favoritism, and I'm concerned that if we have them doling out the suites to charitable purposes, we can't guarantee that they're going to be upholding the integrity of who gets this and that there would be special treatment. So I think it would be better put for us to have that stadium suite revenue go towards paying off the debt so that all taxpayers can benefit from it. So I would ask for a no vote. All those in favor of the A9 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Are there any other amendments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Omar.
I move A8.
Representative Omar moves the A8 amendment to your amendment.
Madam Chair, this amendment sort of allows us to remember the contract that when both of the chambers were Republican-controlled and the stadium bill passed, there were certain representations that were agreed to in regards to Minneapolis having representation at the on this particular board. We know that Minneapolis has made significant investments in this particular deal. $150 million was invested upfront by Minneapolis for debt services, $6 million in operation and maintenance costs. And we are paying $101.5 million per year for capital improvement. Minneapolis has invested almost one-third of the public investment portion that it took to build the stadium was invested by Minneapolis. And so I am asking for us to make sure that Minneapolis is not being taxed without representation and that we have a voice on the board, and this amendment would allow for Minneapolis's voice to be represented. And so I ask all of you to take that into consideration and make sure that those of us who are investing the bigger portion of this have our voices at the table.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this amendment? Okay, seeing none, members, are there any questions or comments to this amendment? Seeing none, members, just my comment on this. I appreciate you bringing this forward. I do want you to know that in the bill, that Minneapolis still retains one member that is serving as part of the new board if passed into law. This actually makes it that you would have three members versus the one two members that you have currently on the board, so it would go even further than what the existing board is. And for that reason, I would encourage a no vote. So, members, with that, all those in favor of the 8-8 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Are there any other amendments? See, members, I've got a couple amendments. I'm going to start with the A3 amendment. And I've got an amendment to the amendment. That's the A5 amendment. And, members, this was language that Representative Scott in the Civil Law Committee has discussed. It's dealing with the data piece, and we have her bill currently in her possession, and it's just taking her language on the data transparency piece and replacing what I've got in the bill with her language instead. And this just reflects what they passed out of the Civil Law Committee. Anybody from the audience that wishes to testify on this at all? Okay, see none. Anybody on the A5 amendment to the amendment, or at least can we get the A5 amendment to the amendment attached? And then if you have discussions to the main one, that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. Okay. So all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? A5 amendment to the amendment is adopted. And members to the A3 amendment as amended. Any questions or comments? Anyone from the audience that has comments to the A3 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. And then, members, I've got the A6 amendment, and this is in response to public input at the last committee hearing, talking about making sure that's a fair market value and not just the price that's determined by the MSFA board. So that's in response to citizen input. And with that, is there anybody from the audience that wishes to testify to the A6 amendment? Mr. Turchik, if you want to come to the table, please. If you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Chuck Turchik. I live in Minneapolis. I thank you for bringing this amendment forward. I just wanted to point out that in the Sports Facilities Authority response to the Legislative Auditor's Report, they submitted an 8-page letter. And in that 8-page letter, there are four things that are underlined. Two of them are exhibits, Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 2. And the two other things are these italicized statements talking about the suites. And the italicized and underlined portion here is at no cost to the authority or the public. And on page MSFA-4, suites at no charge to the authority or public. And in the preceding paragraph, also in italics but not underlined, it says does not require payment of any public funds, talking about their use of the two MSFA suites. So they really emphasize that there was no public expenditure for the tickets that they distributed inappropriately to some people for Vikings games and other events. However, of course, this was a negotiated agreement, the use agreement, where they obtained the suites. So they gave up something for these two suites. They gave up something to get 36 free tickets to the Vikings games. We don't know what they gave up. That's an indeterminable. So I really appreciate the change from the associated cost for these tickets to the fair market value. I think that's a very appropriate change. So I urge you to support the amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Turchik. Any questions for Mr. Turchik? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, in your opinion, would this apply to Speaker Doubt's ticket that he got at Face Valley, I think at that Dallas football game back in December? He paid $165 for it. It was obviously worth more than that. Is that what you're thinking about on this amendment?
This is limited to the piece of legislation that we have before us, which is dealing with the MSFA and the three suites that they have available to them. So it's everything that's under their control. So if they're providing a ticket to an entity, they would need to reimburse that entity that had received that from them. If you're talking about the Representative Lesh bill, that's a separate piece of legislation.
So Speaker Dowd's preferential treatment will let that go. That won't be in this amendment.
Representative Johnson, that will be part of Representative Lesh's bill. So,
okay, thank you.
And Representative Johnson, we are beyond time. I just want to make sure that you're okay with that. If we can finish this up before 3, okay, you're good. Can you please say that on the record? So,
we're good.
Okay, thank you.
I'm good.
All right, good. Members, any other questions? Okay, with that, all those in favor of the A6 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The A6 amendment is adopted. Members, we are to the bill. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to the bill? Mr. Turchik, please come to the table.
Madam Chair, committee members, Chuck Turchik, Minneapolis. At 5:30 this morning, I sent the committee members another one of my crazy emails. Those of you who are on the Government Operations Committee or met with the joint committee meeting with the Senate Committee, probably are tired of my emails by now. I'm not going to go read my entire email, but there are a couple of things that haven't been said in public, I think, that I would like to mention. There seem to be many ironies to me in the circumstances that led to this bill, some of which I've heard public comments about and some of which I have not. One of the ironies is that expert negotiators in responding to this issue demonstrated little in communication skills. Presumably, Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority members and staff are hired in part for their negotiating skills in attracting events to the stadium. Yet the authority's response in this situation shows a complete lack of such negotiating skills. Their written statements in response to the public outcry and to the legislative auditor's report have reeked of lawyerly language. I apologize to the lawyers on the committee. I had suggested to the authority that its response be something like this 7-sentence statement. We screwed up. We have violated the public's trust. We were not good stewards of the taxpayers' money or the public interest. When we invited our family, friends, cronies, business associates, and politicians to view stadium events from the authority's luxury suites with no real stadium marketing or public purpose, we used a public asset and trusted to us as if it was our personal property. That was wrong. We will see to it that others, or we personally, will reimburse the MSFA for the true value those tickets would have for private parties who have paid to lease similar suites. We will try to do better in the future to ensure that public monies and public assets are used for public purposes. Had the authority issued that statement instead of its multi-page responses, I doubt the bill before you would have been drafted. A second irony is that MSFA members care deeply about the success of the stadium, but their response may well have made it more difficult for their successors to achieve that objective. And I refer to the provisions of this bill, which are some believe will limit their marketing options and other provisions that will require extra reporting requirements and extra oversight. So I do ask whether the bill's authors had contacted SMG, the company that was hired to operate and market the stadium, whether they believe the provisions in this bill will make it more difficult to market the stadium for events. A third irony was that inadequate legislative oversight, and I'm referring to the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Sports Facilities that was established by the stadium legislation, inadequate legislative oversight has resulted in a bill seeking more power for the legislature. This bill moves from the governor having three appointees and the city of Minneapolis having two appointees to a majority of the appointees, four out of seven, being selected by the legislature. And I think that even the chair of that legislative commission, Senator Rosen, admits that their oversight was inadequate, at least with respect to this suites issue. So it's ironic that inadequate legislative oversight is now going to lead to more legislative power. A fourth irony that I noticed was that those responsible for the People's Stadium didn't really want to hear from the people. Executive Director of MSFA, Ted Mondale, told the legislative auditor, as he noted in his report, that this was a well-known practice to, quote, legislators, city officials, chamber organizations, and business organizations, unquote, although, quote, maybe not to the person walking down the street, unquote. Well, they heard from a person walking down the street at the time they adopted the use agreement in 2013. They heard from me. I'm a person walking down the street, and they ignored me. So they weren't really interested in hearing from the public. And the fifth and final irony, I'm sorry I'm taking so much up of yours, so much time of yours, that the vote in the Government Operations Committee was 17 to 1. But don't think that this is really a bipartisan bill. The Democrats had no choice but to vote for it, and the Republicans may well be piling on. It's not a coincidence that the eight authors now listed for this bill all come from one party. And we should note that on the authority suites issues, neither the Republicans nor the Democrats on the MSFA, three of them were identified as Democrats and two as Republicans of the initial appointees. None of them responded to this issue when it was raised by a person walking down the street at the time they negotiated this agreement, who did bring up that suites issues and the possibility for an appearance of impropriety down the line. And as I had mentioned, the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority was also a bipartisan committee. And none of them raised this suites issue, even though they had a meeting on October 24, 2013, called specifically to review the use agreement. The MSFA chair, Michelle Kelm-Helgen, did not talk about the MSFA suites in that meeting, and no one raised it in a question. My apologies to you on this committee, who may be either a Democrat or a Republican. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Turchik. Any questions for Mr. Turchik? Is there anyone else that wishes to speak? If you could come down, please. And welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Sarah Anderson.
Welcome.
I'm going to be brief because I know we're getting close to 3 o'clock.
Can you state your name for
Mark
the record?
Mark Hughes. And just let me explain how disappointed I am in Ted Mondale's manager, Chair Helgen. Ted Mondale knew he was getting those tickets and then all of a sudden paid back. He went to work with his dad on Saturday mornings and knew politics when Fritz Mondale was in office. There's no excuse. Absolutely no excuse. As a Minnesotan, I'm disappointed in what happened. If this issue wouldn't happen, we probably wouldn't be here discussing too much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Members, any questions for Mr. Hughes? Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak to this bill? All right. Seeing that, members, questions. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sometime in your career, you're going to do a piece of legislation that you're involved with, and then hopefully you don't watch something on the news and find out that you're saddened and surprised and alarmed of how things came to pass. I was involved with the stadium. We had many meetings, and they were bipartisan. We were in a minority, and the GOP passed the bill, but it was very very much a joint effort, both sides of the aisle. Maury Lanning and this body carried a lot of water, and it was a tough thing to carry on your side, and it was a tough thing to carry on our side, and we put it over the top. So the, when I was watching the news, I was saddened and surprised and alarmed, you know, with the public. I didn't, you know, and I was kind of, I was pretty glad that the auditor took a look. I didn't even know he had, like, special authority to do those sort of things, and I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. And, you know, I've looked at other reports that I know Steve Green's such an expert on and that the auditor's done, and we all look at them, and I hope you do. But I didn't know he had the special authority to do these special assignments. And so I was pretty glad he did, and it was pretty clear from reading that, I think, for everybody that clearly some heads probably had to roll, which we're finding out is happening, and some changes. So, and I believe the changes were going to happen, you know, and I know you're going to do this bill, and I'm probably going to vote for it. I'm not certain how I'm going to vote at this point. I should know. I'm going to decide in about 30 seconds, probably. But, you know, clearly changes have to be made. But keep in mind, there's this stadium, you know, we were going to lose the team. I mean, it's overall, and I know that's not the issue, but I think it's a story that has to be told. It's a wonderful asset, and Minneapolis did bear the brunt of it. And the reason is because economics. They have the economic muscle that an Arden Hills or someone else just doesn't have, the transportation infrastructure. Just so many things. Minneapolis, you know, is a nation leader, and they're going to be a world leader, you know, with all the big corporations, and they're going to buy the suites. I mean, it's math. It comes down to math. So that's, and it's exciting. The world's going to focus a year from now on a positive thing. The world's going to be looking. The Super Bowl is going to be here. It's going to huge amount of money. So this thing is a success. I mean, there's small stuff, which I think is cool, is concerts and all these other things. It has nothing to do with what we're doing here today. I get it. I mean, they've clearly fallen short, and we're going to deal with it, or someone is. I'm certain. But I'm going to step out there, and I know for a fact, and I'll probably be the only one to say it, but Michelle Cohen was a hard worker, and I'm disappointed in this, what happened. But she did a great job. And for those of us that were in that room, across both sides of the aisle, and research staff that were at these meetings, they know that she worked hard. And some of these suite things, like that extra suite, some of that is actually pretty good negotiation. When you're dealing with a major, major company, and to negotiate to get some of these things, granted, they're horribly used, and, you know, I think all of us at the table would love to have, you know, kids in there or something. I mean, obviously the better uses than the Mondale family. Sorry to name names, but, you know, it's just sad to me. But I think there's lessons for all of us. We all can do a better job. You know, I've been to a Gopher football game, and that's probably the next deal. Is that a special perk? It's not that big of a deal to me. I probably would have rather gone to a hockey game personally. But I went, and there was food. And, you know, and I can't remember what I paid or what I did, but, you know, you go in a special door, it's a special treatment. It's not that big of a deal to me, but I can tell you the public would pay. Just like they'd pay for these suite seats, they would pay. So it kind of, none of us are clean here, or I doubt that all of us are clean. We all, I think this comes back to all of us. But anyways, those are my comments, and I'm not necessarily against, I know the public wants us to do right, and I totally support it because this, you know, it's a blemish on all of us. And don't think it's partisan because it's a blemish on all of us. And it's sad because Minnesota's better than us. So.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I appreciate those comments, and I do think that Ms. Kelmhelgen was a hard worker, a public servant to the state for many years, and I do appreciate her service. And you're right, this is a blemish on all of us, and we have an opportunity to hopefully make this a model for the rest of the nation, because it's not limited to Minnesota. And I think Minnesota tends to lead on a lot of issues, and perhaps we'll lead on this one as well. So thank you. Members, any other comments? Okay, with that, I'm just going to give final comments. I just ask for your support, members. I think I appreciate the feedback that members have given on this bill. I encourage you to continue to do that as we look at this. There's much that can be learned from this entire process, and hopefully we all take it to heart. Representative Nash?
Madam Chair, if I could, I'd like to roll call this.
Representative Nash requests the roll call. And hopefully I didn't miss anybody. Did anybody else want to speak? Okay. If the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Anderson?
Yes.
Rep. Nash?
Yes.
Rep. Johnson?
No.
Rep. Detmer?
Yes.
Rep. Fenton?
Yes.
Rep. Flanagan?
Yes.
Rep. Green?
Yes.
Rep. Kunesh-Podein?
Yes.
Rep. Lilly?
Pass.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Rep. Olson?
Yes.
Rep. Olmar?
Yes.
Rep. Pugh?
Yes.
Rep. Quam?
Yes.
Rep. Uglum?
Yes.
Rep. Vogel?
Yes.
Rep. Ward?
Yes.
Rep. Lilly?
Yes.
On a vote of 16-1, House File 778 is passed and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, next week we'll probably be doing some legislation in committee. I appreciate you staying late now so that we don't have to do it later on this evening. And look forward to seeing you next week. With that, we are adjourned.